Welcome back to the Animals at Home podcast. My name is Dylan Perrin, and thank you so much for tuning in today. By the way, some of you may have noticed I've been recording a lot of podcasts in the evening as of late, which is why I'm sitting in a total black room. If you're new to the podcast and you're wondering, why is this guy sitting in total darkness? Well, it's because my animals are, the lights are out. It's nighttime, so the lights are out. But typically, there's things going on behind me, which you'll see later on the episode. Anyway, introducing my guests today, I'm joined by a Canadian duo, Ryan and Mike of Strange Life Labs. Strange Life Labs is a collaboration between aquatic fish keeping and reptile keeping. Mike is the reptile keeper and Ryan is the fish keeper. He has an incredibly beautiful planted aquarium, which he walks us through how, the equipment that he uses, how he is so successful at creating such a thriving aquarium. He also talks about what species and sort of systems that would work well for somebody that wants to get into fish keeping coming from a reptile keeping background. Mike walks us through his collection of Felsuma, the experience he has working with that group of species, and which the pros and cons of each of the species that he currently works with. He also walks us through his reptile room and the pros and cons of the turtle species he keeps. We also discuss sustainability. What are some ways that you can actually reduce the cost of keeping as well as reduce the energy that you're using to keep your animals? There are so many different topics in this conversation, but I think one of the most important ones is how important it is to be able to collaborate with people and build friendships around the concept of keeping animals in captivity, because you and another person can really push beyond just what you're capable of doing yourself. You know, there's always more that can come out of a situation when you collaborate and combine with people. And I think they highlight that perfectly with this episode. Let's jump into it. Enjoy. Awesome. Well, Mike and Ryan, welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for doing this.
Thanks for having us.
Hey, Dylan. Thanks for having us.
I'm grateful to have you both on. I mean, it's always nice to talk to other Canadians. Actually, is one of you in Calgary and one of you in Edmonton, or you told me that you're both in different cities. So
I'm down in, I'm about 2 hours south of Calgary. I'm in a smaller city called Lethbridge.
Oh yeah. I know Lethbridge. Yeah.
Yeah, I work in Calgary and I live in Okotoks. So yeah. It's about a 40-minute drive.
I know where that is. Yeah. There's a big baseball community there.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I live about 2 minutes away from that baseball diamond. It's great.
Yeah. I know someone that went to that academy, so that's pretty cool. And obviously, nice. You know, being an athlete in Canada, I've been to Lethbridge quite a few times to race myself at the university there. So familiar with those areas. It's great part of the country. I'm excited to have you guys on for more than just the fact that you're in Alberta. You have a really cool page and you guys are kind of off to some interesting projects, and I can't wait to get into that more. But let's just start with a quick background for each of you, kind of, you know, who you are, what you keep, and why. You can just briefly give us, you know, why you've gravitated towards what you keep. We will get into that deeper later, but if you want to just give us kind of the elevator pitch and then we'll go from there. So why don't we start with Mike?
Sorry, and it was just kind of like an overview of what we keep and like how we got into it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I've been keeping, I think I got my first kind of reptile or amphibian when I was 13 or 14 years old. I got my first white tree frog. And so I've kind of just been keeping more or less like steadily over the last 20 years. And some stuff has kind of changed, obviously, with living situations, but kind of this iteration that I'm in now, I have a couple of species of day geckos, some anoles and whatnot, and I'm actually kind of able to breed a couple on a little bit of a larger scale than I have previously. And so that's been going on for the past couple, like 3 years, I think, or so. And then I also have some turtles because that's kind of my first love. And but those are just more so, I guess, like pets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what about you, Ryan?
Well, right now I have mostly all aquariums. Mike and I actually met in university in Lethbridge, and we kind of shared our, I guess, experience with having reptiles when we were probably in our teens. Mm-hmm. Eventually, we worked at a pet store together, and that's kind of where, and we eventually became roommates, and that's when we really started to get a bunch of pets together. And eventually, I moved back to Calgary. He stayed in Lethbridge. I kind of focus for our little project here on the aquarium side of things. So right now I have a 70-gallon by volume high-tech planted tank with, and this is kind of the tank that I've always wanted to have that my wife has finally allowed me to have. So this is right in the living room, kind of the culmination of all my years of fish keeping experience, trying to hide things underneath. So you barely see any equipment. It's all just, you know, nature, boom, right there in your living room. Other than that, I have a 15-gallon breeding tank, which is just behind me here. This is kind of just used for like random breeding projects and, you know, if I need it for a treatment tank type thing. I'm also growing some black worms and basically any fish are in there that I don't want to jump out of the show tank upstairs. So in the meantime, I'm trying to get my hands on another jumping spider because I'm a huge fan of inverts. I've had some mantids in the past, but it's kind of just not the right time, especially with a toddler at home, to be jumping into too many projects. So for now, it's just focused mainly on fish.
Yeah, yeah. So okay, so that's where you guys met was at university. And then, so did you become friends and realize you have this passion together for keeping interesting animals and then decide to be roommates?
Yeah, I think so. I actually remember the day that we met. I'm sure Mike does too. We were cramming for, I think it was an introductory biogenetics class, and both kind of just studying in the same spot, and eventually just started asking each other questions. And I don't think our experience with reptiles or aquariums or anything ever really came up until probably a couple months after we had met. So it's cool to see that friendship kind of blossom. And, you know, once I was out of res at the university, I was looking for a roommate, and Mike was just kind of the perfect choice. So yeah, it's great how everything came together.
And what sort of things? Oh yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Oh, I was just gonna say, yeah, and then like our first place together just ended up with kind of like the stainless steel baker's racks just full of, I think we had mantellas at that point. Ryan had this nano fish tank, which is kind of also something that we're both kind of passionate about, is the kind of the smaller scale say of things on the aquariums. Some day geckos. I think we had a tarantula for a second, and that didn't work out.
What happened to the tarantula?
We still don't know.
Oh, it disappeared.
So I got it. It was kind of, we went to a show up in Calgary, and just kind of, again, this was, you know, young, undisciplined, and just like saw a Brazilian white knee tarantula. I don't know if you've seen those before, but yeah, they're like hand size. They're massive, and they had like little slings. So I was like, oh man, that'd be super cool. And then I think like, I thought it was in an airtight enclosure. You know, I've never kept anything like that. Sure enough, going in the morning, and there's an empty critter keeper.
So you're like, okay, now I have a wild tarantula living in the house. I assume it eventually died, but you never know.
Yeah, I probably didn't even make it off the rack, but yeah, anytime we'd be in bed or something at night, you just feel something.
Yeah, it's always it's dangerous when you get two people that are in this, you know, within the hobby that we're all in, living together with, you know, the student spending mentality where you don't really have a concept for, you know, like where's the off switch? You're just like, let's go to the show and buy a bunch of things and just spend money.
What can go
wrong? I remember Mike and I bought this, I think it was like a 70-gallon marine. It was a used marine aquarium with like a sump and everything. We got a really good deal on it, and we just never set it up. It's like that kind of university attitude, like, you know, we already have all these pets and let's buy this used aquarium and see where it goes. But I think we ended up just flipping it or something.
Yeah, you know, that's something really accessible for a university student, is like one of the most expensive hobbies. I feel yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So eventually, obviously, you moved, like you said, Ryan, you moved back to Calgary, and so I assume those animals got separated. Did you guys kind of divide what you had and take home, or did you just sort of piece out what you had to sell and then restart your own collections at home?
Well, I really just had the fish tank, like Mike had a lot of the terrariums and stuff. Eventually, I think I turned my freshwater tank into a saltwater tank, so I rehomed a bunch of the fish, and that's when I got into the saltwater hobby. We were, like I said before, we were working at a pet store, and back then they actually had a ton of really cool saltwater fish and invertebrates. So that's where I kind of got into that. But Mike and I lived together for probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, Mike, maybe 4 years. And then that's when we decided I was going to go back to Calgary and, you know, take some further schooling. And I think what led to our Instagram page, which is Strange Life, Mike was using Strangelife kind of to post his photography. This was, I actually went back and looked at the timestamps. This was in like 2018 that I think he started it, Mike. And I think eventually he just wanted to revive it. And he invited me to start contributing, I think back in 2020. So I've kind of always handled the, at that time it was mostly reef stuff. So if you go back far enough on that feed, you'll start seeing like tons of reef pictures. And then eventually I got out of the reef tank hobby, and I just wanted something that fit more with my lifestyle. So I went back to freshwater.
Yeah, it is a really neat collaboration when you scroll through the Instagram page, because you do have, I mean, these incredible freshwater tanks with all, you know, several different species of reptile as well. So maybe, Mike, you could just lay it out for people, just if who have not seen your Instagram page before, what sort of things are they going to see and learn from just scrolling through the page?
Yeah, so kind of what I started is kind of collecting more and more animals just now that I'm in a permanent space. I'm in a place where we're able to purchase a home, so I had some room to work with. So I kind of took actually a lot of inspiration from Diane with Reptiliatus. Like, he just keeps some really unique species and stuff that you can tell he's really passionate about. So I've been like, since university and our undergrad, we both have a biology degree. Like Brian was saying, that's where we met. But Brian was kind of more on the micro side of things. I was more on the macro side of things. So like ecology, like specifically like island biogeography, really caught my interest. So like at that time, Madagascar, just like I could not get enough about just reading about the ecology of Madagascar. So I was looking for neons and standing eye specifically, and they were just not available to where I was. So, you know, fast forward a couple years and I was able to actually find a pair of both. So that kind of started it. So I've got them, the standing eye, the neons, and then I've also got some peacocks, which I just got, which are one of the funnest species for sure. And then from there, I also really like herp time too. And so I kind of just started looking at anoles, because I mean, like I remember being like 12 and just looking at the green anoles and just thinking those are like the coolest looking animal. Mm-hmm. So I actually got some neotropical anoles, which are just like giant green anoles, but they're really mellow. They got a really fun personality. They're a little ornery sometimes, but I think that's half the fun, is just having a little bit of a personality to work around with. And then also I just got some Cordifanes cristatus, which I think is the angle-headed iguana. And those are really cool too, kind of the more obscure gamut side of things. And yeah, those are definitely things that I'm passionate about. And then like I was saying, I've got a ornate wood turtle and a loggerhead musk turtle. Originally, kind of when I had the space, I really wanted to explore breeding turtles, but that was really interesting because I don't want to paint with broad strokes here, but it seems like one of the animals that what you see are being kept really improperly or in not the greatest conditions, I feel like, are often aquatic turtles. Mm-hmm. And so there's also like, I find like a huge oversupply. So it just kind of like had time to think about it. Just, you know, I'd rather just keep those things as pets and something to just enjoy and give them as much space and kind of watch them just do their thing and move towards the geckos and the lizards, which I think are, you know, with some of these smaller species just make a lot more sense and I think tend to do a lot better in captivity.
Yeah. Those are great points. And I definitely want to ask you about the turtles as well, because I think there is still going to be a sector of people who just want to keep turtles. They really want to. So I'll pick your brain about those two species in particular, if they do make good pets. And I'm curious, between the two of you, you know, you kind of mentioned that Ryan's more focused on the micro and you're more focused on the macro, Mike. As far as, are you guys able to collaborate with each other? You know, Ryan, you're keeping the freshwater fish, especially these incredible planted tank. Are you able to share information between each other to help each other grow as far as how you keep? Because there is, in some ways, quite an overlap between reptile keeping and aquatics, but they're also very separate. So I don't know, do you guys collaborate at all in that domain, Ryan?
For sure, yeah. I mean, Mike's always been kind of my go-to guy to ask for anything terrarium related. And I think it's kind of the same the other way around with aquariums. Like if Mike has any issues with his turtle tank, you know, I'll kind of advise him on it. And, you know, I've never kept a turtle myself. And funny story, actually, this was probably like a year ago. I actually envisioned my big show tank to be a turtle tank And you know, you want to talk about strengths and weaknesses, like Mike absolutely keeps some of those really dumb ideas of mine in check. You know, the thought of, you know, the image in your head of a, you know, a small aquatic turtle in a beautiful planted tank is great. But when you, you know, reach out to somebody who knows what they're doing, you know, they bring you back down to earth pretty quick. But yeah, when Mike's starting up new builds or when I'm starting up terrariums, you know, I had a terrarium probably, you know, a year ago for one of my mantids. And, you know, Mike was a great source of advice for, you know, how to make it look and work, you know, just as well as you want it to. And yeah, that's the great part about me and Mike's collaboration is we kind of have our own strengths and weaknesses built up over the years of experience we've had in the hobby, and we can kind of bounce back ideas off each other and, you know, keep each other in check.
And I think, like, kind of to further expand on that, like, if you were to look at my setups compared to Ryan's, like, you would see Ryan's are just so much more aesthetically pleasing. And that's something that definitely, Ryan really helps me out with a lot. Like, I'll have something set up and I'll be like, oh, this looks great. And then, you know, Ryan will come down or whatever. Cause we also are, we both fly fish. So that's another reason for us to get together. And you'll just come in and, you know, like, make a couple observations or point something out. And it's just like, you know, totally went over my head. And then, like, just being able to take that input and just make some of these enclosures look way nicer. And then, I mean, ultimately, I feel like I enjoy them more as well, because it's not just looking at something that's totally utilitarian and has, you know, actually brings something almost like decorative to this space.
Right. It's not just also our, like the builds we have. It's also when it comes down to photography and stuff like that too. When we're trying to make content on Instagram that, really pops or tries to, you know, take advantage of whatever algorithm Instagram is trying to follow. Like, I think we're really good at bouncing ideas off each other. And, you know, if Mike creates a reel, you know, that doesn't in my work. Opinion, doesn't live up to
I was like, I'll help you out.
The quality, like, you know, we have a great relationship. I can tell Mike, like, you know, get closer to your animal, you know, edit it this way, and or just send me the clips and I'll show you how to edit it. So we have a really great relationship like that, where nothing's really off limits when it comes to collaborating or getting advice.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I really like about this, the page and what you guys are up to. And I think it's a good model for others to kind of follow, because not only are you able to collaborate on trying to grow the Instagram page, which is, you know, kind of a, it's a real ball of wax for most people. You know, you don't know what's going to work, what's not. So it's nice to, like, get together with another person to try to work out that, you know, equation essentially, but also to have two separate hobbies to some extent, but also to have this overarching, you know, unity between them is so powerful. And like you said, Mike, you know, some people have just such an eye for creating beauty in an enclosure, where I feel like I don't have that. I feel like everything I make looks great because you just don't have, like, the dessert. Like, you just look at it, you're like, I think that's good. Like, it's like sometimes you listen to a song and you can't tell if it's good or bad because you just feel like, I don't know why, you just don't have that artist mind. You're like, I think this could be good. I have no idea. That's how I always feel. So you need that other person to be like, no, you could put this plant here, you know, move these branches back, whatever it is. And then vice versa. And you guys can grow together so much faster than if you're kind of working in a silo.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Especially with, like, Ryan was saying, the Instagram stuff, like, it'll be funny because, like, he'll be like, hey man, try this, you know, very gently over a couple of weeks. I'm like, no, do the one thing that Ryan's been asking me to do or has suggested. And then all of a sudden, exposure to that particular content is just like through the roof. Yeah, stuff that, like, I would have never thought about or even thought to look for.
Yeah, I mean, when Mike started Strange Life, I think his following was mostly all reptile keepers. And, you know, most people who keep reptiles, they look at an aquarium, or even vice versa, aquarium owners look at reptile enclosures or terrariums and they think, like, wow, this is gorgeous. So to be able to, I don't know, kind of have both of a foot in both of those waters, I think that's what makes our Instagram page really special. And then further to that, you know, we've been kind of wanting to move how we do our hobby into a more sustainable direction. So, and, you know, I think most people want to do this. Like, they want to grow their own food for their animals. They want to, you know, use vegetable scraps from their kitchen to grow, food that their animals eat, right? So that's kind of where we've been pushing things and trying to increase the self-sustainability of the hobby, because, you know, at the end of the day, there's a lot of equipment that goes into making some of these enclosures or aquariums, and, you know, they're not really the most environmentally friendly, right? And when you factor in that people are oftentimes collecting these animals from the wild to the detriment of their natural habitats, you know, we kind of want to take it, and that's kind of the vision for the page. We want to take it into a self-sustaining captive bred direction.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, as far as where do you see it going as far as Strange Life Labs? Is this something that it's just a passion project, or is it something that's going to develop into a little bit deeper? But I, in some ways you answered that question, but do you think it'll eventually be more of like a business, or will it be always just kind of showing people ways to do things effectively and efficiently?
I think that we had, like, initially we had an idea where we're like, we want this to be a business. Like, we want, you know, hard goods, whatever. And I think just like having, you know, having that goal for a while and just really kind of trying to exhaust and brainstorm some ideas for stuff, it almost made it less fun. So we've kind of almost pivoted to a point of just posting what we like, kind of keeping what we like, and just if we're not fully into something, to not do it, and just kind of let that kind of dictate the pace. And actually, since we started to do that, we've seen like quite, or at least I feel like we've seen a lot more growth. Like, Ryan works, we'll collaborate really often with Fluval Aquatics. They've been so good to us. And like through this page as well,
I've,
yeah, they've been awesome. Been able to connect with a local store here called Fishy on Fifth. Like, able to just kind of collaborate with that guy and kind of see the community that they're help building locally, which is something like I feel that hasn't always been around. And it's really cool to kind of see. I feel like there's a little bit of a shift in herpetoculture and even aquatics too, where people are trying to take steps to make it a lot more of an inclusive space, and being able to kind of see that actually happen, like on a local scale. Like, that's been really cool. So I think that's something too that I want to kind of perpetuate through Strange Life Labs too. So whether that's a business or, you know, a community, whatever that is.
Yeah. When further to that, like when Mike and I, when kind of Strange Life started taking off, our ultimate goal was kind of just to get some of the bigger brands on board so that, you know, maybe this hobby would get less expensive. But we didn't really put pressure on ourselves to reach any goals. We just wanted to make good content, and we wanted to share our knowledge and, you know, learn from other people in the community. And I feel like we're at a point now where, you know, we've got some of these great brands engaging with us and, you know, helping us out in that way. So now we kind of just want to take it into a, you know, sustainable direction, not put too much pressure on ourselves to create a product or a service. A lot of us, or me and Mike right now, you know, whether it's me selling moss or plant clippings or, you know, live feeders, you know, that's kind of, you know, keeping us involved locally in the hobby and, you know, forming these connections close by to where we live, which, in my opinion, even if, you know, we can't turn this into a business, that's good enough for me, right? So that's kind of where I see Lab going. I think Mike feels the same way.
For sure.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point to make. I mean, you can create a brand without having a vision for making it a business, right? And that's kind of what it is. I mean, I love the name, but the feel of the page and the way the page itself looks, just you could see that eventually, if you wanted to pivot into some kind of business that fits that brand. But for right now, building the community, I think, is the most important part, and following the passion to make it interesting and fun to do. Can we dig into the sustainability piece a little bit? I'd be curious to know, like, kind of what are some of the ideas? I know you mentioned growing food and whatnot, but are there some other things that you both are working on that can help us in that area?
I mean, speaking to myself, I know, like, it's hard because there's certain things that you need, and like, it's really cool that now UVB is kind of being able to be offered through like LED sources, but like making sure that whatever can be LED and less of a power drain is happening, having things like thermostats and hydrostats. So instead of just continuously running these things that are just drawing power, just doing it when you need, and looking at keeping things that are relatively similar climates together so that you're not having to kind of fight these different environmental parameters, and then which I think ends up creating a lot of energy waste potentially as well. If you've got these arid species and then you're trying to keep these tropical species on the other side of the room, like those are things that aren't going to kind of agree. And as a result, you know, it's possible to do it, but you know, it'll just take a lot more external power and energy to actually do that. Mm-hmm.
One thing I forgot to say is I forgot to tell you guys before we started that when my lights go off behind me, it looks like I'm a ghost now. I always forget to warn the guests because my actual camera is recording. The lighting is fine on my real camera, but the webcam that the guest sees.
Oh, I see.
So it's like there's always this moment where the lights go off and the guest is like, oh my God, he, no one can see his face anymore. So anyway, just pretend you can still see me and I'm not just eyes floating. Ryan, do you have anything to add to that as far as sustainability?
Yeah, you know what? I don't want to waste, you know, food for my animals, right? So for us, you know, for me and my wife, like having sustainable practices is important. And, you know, I also don't want to be throwing away money on fish food, you know, multiple times a month as well. So I think fish just look better and behave more naturally when they're eating live food. So for the past year or so, I've been growing Daphnia and black worms, you know, mixed success with some other live feeders just because of the, you know, the yuck factor in a lot of ways. And, you know, the smells that emanate from my basement when I try to grow certain, you know, worm cultures or something. So right now I've been having a lot of success with black worms. And I think a lot of other hobbyists are hungry for that sort of, you know, kind of side hustle or side hobby that helps their, you know, fish maintain brilliant colors. And it's a really simple thing to do with a hang-on filter on the side of your aquarium. So I'm just waiting until I have, you know, enough of a really nice looking reel to post this to Strange Life. And I think it's going to take off. In where I live anyway, black worms aren't necessarily that readily available. So, you know, there's lots of interest from the local hobbyists around here on adding that, that ability into their hobby. And, you know, we all have tons of little side projects with our hobby that are fun to try. So that's just another one that I think most people are going to be down for.
Yeah. Well, I think moving forward, as things become more and more expensive, as we've noticed in the past 4 or 5 years, especially in Canada, but also in the United States, just the concept of being able to do it cheaper without impacting the health of your animals is going to be so incredibly important. So whether that is growing your own food or like you said, Mike, just reducing how you use your lighting, or even if you're somebody who's just getting into the hobby, maybe trying to keep animals that are within the climate that you live in. So not necessarily the outside climate, but managing the humidities and whatnot, or not having to manage the humidities and the temperature inside as much as you would have for, you know, an arid species that's from Africa or something, you know, something that you're having to pump a ton of wattage into to keep the temperatures up. There's lots of ways that you can actually save money, and that will become more important because people are going to have to start creating. You don't want to call them shortcuts because you want them to be effective ways of saving money, like I said, without actually impacting the animals. So it'll be really cool to watch that develop with you guys as you know, create different ideas, because yeah, it's going to be crucial, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that.
Mike, I'd love to dig into a little bit more of you had mentioned some of the species of gecko that you work with, and maybe you could just list them again if folks missed it off the top of the show. And you had said that Madagascar, you're really drawn to just the island kind of ecosystem. Is that where the passion for those species came from? Or just give us kind of the rundown of why you chose those specific animals.
For sure. So at that time, I was just keeping, not to age myself too much, but crested geckos were kind of newer on the scene, and the same with like the Lichianus and all those New Caledonian. And so just like, it was just really intrigued me that there was just this huge variety of animals in this really small geographical space. So it kind of drew me to the topic of island biogeography. And as soon as, like that was in like the school sense of things. And so of course you can't look at that without looking at Madagascar. And so just like seeing this incredible diversity of geckos. Like, that's the genus Valsuma. Like, they live in just like so many different niches and have occupied so many. They're just able to do so much and have so much diversity when just like some of them live just like kilometers apart and just you couldn't even tell that they're related. And so that really drew me. And really also too, I think it's important, like at that time I was keeping lots of nocturnal species and I still have nocturnal species. Like I have gargoyle geckos because I just they're just so fun and they just look really funny too. They're just easy to keep. But having a species of gecko that is out all day and is really interactive. And like as soon as I walk into my room and like anyone who's kept day geckos or been around them, you know, they can be a little bit frantic and whatnot. But I almost find that they're almost like prairie dogs or gophers in the sense that like their curiosity just like cannot help but get the better of them. So I mean, if you stay in that room for, you know, even a minute, they cannot help themselves and they have to come out and see what you're doing. Same with when you're doing maintenance. So I've just found like a personality on them. And I'm not saying it doesn't exist with other species, but that's just something that really kind of resonated with me. Because my first species that I kept was the grandis.
Yeah, I was
And
gonna
I just
ask if
had
you kept
never had.
Grandis. Yeah.
Yeah, that was the first one. We had somebody at the store. They brought in like, I think it was like six. So we actually had like this little posse, like a Brian and myself and people that worked at the pet store. We all kind of had this grandis. And I think all of our experiences was really similar and just that it was just so much personality in this animal that I just hadn't seen really in other species. And that just kind of really resonated with me. So, and like even the standing eye, like as soon as I saw them, like it didn't even matter. I just had the blinders on. I was like, I need to get that species and just start working with them. And I think they're starting to get more popular too. Just because also, like I was saying, some of these smaller species, they're just a lot easier to keep in some of these spaces, like the neons, like the Klemmerei. And it's just the interaction and the social piece. I just haven't seen as much in reptiles. And I just think it's really interesting to watch these really natural behaviors occur in like the corner of your living room or in your unfinished basement, like myself.
If you are interested in supporting the podcast and simultaneously supporting the welfare of your reptile at home, make sure you check out Custom Reptile Habitats for their premium enclosures. You can find an affiliate link in both the YouTube description or the show notes, or just head to animalsathome.ca/CRH. If you use that link and head to their website to make a purchase, a commission comes back to me at no extra cost to you. And of course, that helps me support the show. Alternatively, you can join us over on Patreon at patreon.com/animalsathome. For as little as 75 cents per episode, you can support the podcast and you will automatically be entered into the Discord server so you can have conversations with like-minded keepers. If you do bump yourself up to the $5 per month tier, you will have early access to episodes and the opportunity to submit questions to upcoming guests. Yeah. Well, and with some of those smaller species, even the larger ones, if you keep them in a large enough enclosure, you can start keeping in colonies and watching some, you know, dynamics of a group. And I remember the first time I saw a Klemmerei, a baby in person, you don't realize how tiny they are. They're insanely small. And I mean, they're also small when they're adults too. But I'm curious, as far as the personalities or just behavior goes, would you say each species is very similar? Like, I've only kept Grandis, that's my only kind of experience, but are they similar just to different degrees, obviously different body plans and sizes and whatnot, or are they very different across species?
I think that's a really good question. So actually your last episode with the gentleman from Canadian Cold-Blooded, the way that he was talking about like the personality of the tree monitors, I think is really interesting and kind of relevant to the day geckos too, because like there's general rules for species. But then you'll always have kind of the outliers. Like, so generally neons everywhere you read and lots of people that keep them, you know, they are really outgoing. They're really bold. My pair are not that. They're very skeptical and really, I have to have something for them to actually want to come out. Like I've got to have a cricket or something on the end of the tongs and then they'll come out. Whereas I don't think that's the experience with everyone, but I found like, I've also kept gold dusts or Latakata in the past too, and I found those to be a super flighty species. Just no matter what you do, they're just not as comfortable being out and exposed out with you in the room. And then the standing eye, I have found to be really, really bold. Like they'll just like he'll come over, he'll eat from my finger. If I'm planting something in there, the male will come over and sometimes get almost obnoxiously in the way while you're trying to get something. Like they're just. I found them as a species have just been really outgoing. That being said, do I handle them? No, I can't actually, you know, handle them and grab them, but they're able to come over and kind of interact with me on their own accord. And that's something that, to me, that's what I want. Like my wife has a bearded dragon. They're buddies. They get to hang out and pet, but that's not really what I'm looking for in a pet. So it's really cool to just see that these animals recognize you, and they're visual animals too. They're visual hunters. So they're able to recognize and discern people when they come in the rooms. So like my wife is coming down here, they know it's her. Whereas when I'm coming down, they'll have a totally different reaction.
Yeah. 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 It's pretty fascinating. I had a similar experience with the grandest that I kept, and it is, they are similar to keeping fish in some extent. And I guess, Ryan, if you kept a grandis as well, you might have felt this too, is there's, it's a hands-off scenario, right? You're able to create this environment, but you're not trying to handle them. They can be quite flighty, so you're not trying to open the door and let them run around and whatnot. And to me, that's, I like that style of keeping as well. I don't need to be interacting physically with the animals that I'm keeping. I very rarely do. All my snakes are handleable, but I don't do it on a regular basis just because I like to watch them. And I think there's so many species of gecko that are not in the hobby that fit that bill. And all, a lot of the Felsuma really do fall into that category. It's just these incredible diurnal species that are very active that you don't need. I mean, no reptile you really need to be holding, but you don't need to be constantly trying to grab them and whatnot. They're just to watch. And I think that's a kind of a fascinating element of that group.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely agree. And like to say, you know, as far as personalities go as a whole for species, I forgot to mention like grandis, like we're just kind of recounting, like they're almost like the golden retrievers of Felsuma. They're by far the most sociable. That's the only species where I could consistently handle one. Like you come onto my hand or whatnot. I think that's such a good entry point for anyone that wants to get into Felsuma, because they have a lot of the less desirable traits, I guess, in that they can be pretty flighty. If you surprise them, you know, they're on the other side of that enclosure in a, you know, half a second, but they're a little bit more forgiving. They're bigger. They're a little bit more robust. They're not as picky. I find that sometimes, especially with the smaller species, they can get a little picky and hard to feed, and the Felsuma are just garbage disposals. They'll just take a whack at anything.
Yeah. 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 That's always a bonus. Yeah, the grandis, yeah. You had, I think it was a clip on the Instagram page, I guess it probably was, of doing like a DIY gecko food. I assume you use that for Felsuma and probably your gargoyle geckos as well. I think you're using a base powder of, you know, a brand, but you were also adding some stuff to it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so basically, like that was based on my own research and just kind of watching some people that I've been keeping some of these species forever and ever. And really, when you look at the ingredients on some of the prepared commercial gecko diet, like it's awesome. They're using whole ingredients and stuff, but in a lot of cases, you're only getting a protein from one species of animal. So often that's the black soldier fly. And I mean, that's a great high calcium choice, but if that's making up a big part of an animal's diet, you're not kind of eliminating the fact that that's, you know, like you've discussed with other guests previously on your show, like there's so few species in the world that are only eating, you know, one kind of feeder animal or, you know, one species of prey. And so what I just try to do is just, I've got like, you know, ground up crickets, like gutload of crickets, ground up dubia roaches, ground up mealworms to a lesser extent, but just for the sake of diversity, and just adding that at about 10% dry weight to whatever I'm offering for the commercial gecko food is just a way to get some diversity in their diet and help break things up. And it's, I actually kind of did a little bit of an experiment with my gargoyles just to see just if, you know, they'd actually like it, or if I'm just kind of anthropomorphizing or maybe getting more involved than I should. And I found that adding that extra animal protein made it a lot more appealing and a lot more appetizing. And so same, once I, you know, figured that out with them, I extended out to all my species really. And you can really tell the difference for sure. Like in some cases, like the standing eye behind me, they'll lick when I've got crickets or roaches in that mix, they'll lick it dry. There'll be nothing left in that little ramekin. Yeah.
And do you do that every feed or do you space it out in between?
So anytime I'm offering the gecko food, it's always got the extra protein in it.
Okay.
Just cause, but I try to make a really concerted effort to, to offer that diversity. So, you know, offering whole prey items, natural food items, like just like with people, we know that that's just becoming more and more important in nutrition, is that what we're eating ourselves is not being processed or has too many hands involved in it. And so that's why I try to offer maybe more bugs than maybe some other people would. And that's just based on my own experience. So I try really hard to push feeders wherever I can, and then offering the gecko diet, you know, twice a week most. Yeah. But, you know, having high day, like some fruit flies for the smaller species, just alternating between like the high day and the melanogaster, getting pinhead crickets, which is an absolute pain in the butt, but getting those in, having black soldier flies that actually pupate into flies, and offering those as well. Again, just like Ryan was saying, it seems like a lot of work, and it is work for sure, but it's almost like a sub hobby in that, you know, growing those own feeders and kind of offering that, it's just part and parcel. And it actually kind of, I feel like, makes me enjoy sometimes animal keeping more than I would otherwise, because it's just a change in perspective and pace than, you know, scraping glass or, you know, trimming plants.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It does become a hobby within a hobby, you know, learning nutrition and caring for your feeder insects and whatnot. You know, it can get pretty complicated, but it saves the money. But but most excitingly, it can be an interesting aspect of keeping. I'm going to ask you one more question about reptiles, Mike, and then we'll come back because I want to talk to you about the turtles, but then we'll go to Ryan before we do that because I want to hear more about what he's doing. But I you had mentioned that you keep gargoyles, and I think you'd started with crested geckos and other New Caledonian geckos, and I know on your page you had mentioned that you just love the gargoyles compared to the previous New Caledonians you've kept in the past. Mm-hmm. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, like when you just look at them, even I think I love crested geckos. I don't want to sound like I'm just dragging them, but like when you look at a gargoyle gecko, like it looks like its head looks like a crocodile. Like it's just the coolest looking head, I think. And then that just slapped on top of these little tiny pot bellies. Like it's just this really odd mix. They almost look like a literal, like carved marble gargoyle. They just look really interesting. But that aside, I think what really drew me to them was their personality. Like I'm going to jinx myself, but I'm yet to be bit by a garg. Like they're just really, really easy. They're just almost a good ambassador for keeping geckos, just in the sense that they're really forgiving. They're super easy to keep. They look really cool. Some of the morphs that they've got available now are just insane. And it's just, for whatever reason, I just really gravitated towards that over cresties. And I think it just had to do with the fact that they just look like little potbelly alligators hanging out in a tree. And, they grow back their tails too, which is always nice too when you're first getting into the hobby and maybe make a misstep that you didn't mean to make. But I just found that they're really interesting in that regard. And then, you know, nowadays with the taxonomy, with all the stuff on New Caledonia being kind of recategorized, I think Lichianus are one of the coolest species ever. And, you know, if I had that kind of, you know, one day I'd love to have some, but, you know, they're just really expensive and not the most accessible species. But they're seeing the work that they've done that shows that, you know, the gargoyles and the lychees are really quite a bit more closely related than the others. I just also think that's cool because it's just like a little tiny lychee with maybe a little bit of a better personality.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they do look cool. And it's so funny. Some of us got into crested geckos, like you said, when they were becoming popular back in the, you know, early 2000s or whatever, mid like 2005, 2006. And I, for whatever reason, the gargoyles felt like they took longer to catch on, man. And they are really unique looking species, not to mention the colors and the patterns that they produce is pretty cool. So Ryan, could you walk us through the planted aquarium that you have? And I would love for you to mention some of the species of fish that you keep as well, because I don't think you mentioned that yet.
Yeah, sure. So the planted tank is a water box clear. I think it works out to about 72 gallons empty. But when you account for this aqua decor custom background that I got made, I've done some calculations. I think it's around 55 gallons, but it's kind of impossible to know for sure. So whenever I'm dosing anything, I just kind of assume 55 gallons, and I think it gets me in the ballpark. I think, like I said earlier, I really like the idea of hiding a lot of the tech out of view. So the background has these chambers in the corners that allows me to put a filter input kind of hidden away. That's where I hide the heater. On the other side, there's some emergent Monstera plants and Pothos plants coming out. That's where I can hide all of the ugly root systems of those plants so they stay out of the display. Underneath the tank is a Flugel FX6, which is the biggest filter that Flugel makes. I think it's marketed for up to 400 gallons, so it might seem like a big overkill, but I do split the returns off of it. So what I gain from doing that is basically no dead spots in the aquarium where detritus can build up. Obviously, for anyone who's kept aquariums, any detritus building up in the water eventually is going to break down into organics that are going to fuel algae growth. So that's another way that I keep the aquarium really clean. Also, another reason why I really went up, you know, as high as I could with the filters, because I have an inline CO2 reactor. So CO2 is one of those things for anybody who's kept aquariums. It just makes your life so much easier. The CO2 reactor basically keeps all these really tiny CO2 bubbles out of the aquarium. So it makes the whole thing just look more natural. In nature, underneath the gravel bed of these lakes or rivers, you have decaying organic matter, and bacteria are constantly breaking those down and releasing CO2 into the water column. In our home aquariums, we can't do that, right? If we did that, it would just look like a mucky mess, right? So to make plant growth as good as it could be, you have to dissolve CO2 in the water column. Some people can do that with liquid CO2 additives, but really what works best is dissolved CO2 gas. So what I gain with the CO2 reactor, not just being able to keep these tiny bubbles out, but I maintain almost 100% efficiency in each CO2 bubble that gets dissolved in the water, doesn't actually bubble up and, you know, go into my living room. So I cut down on the amount of CO2 I'm buying every year. I have a 20-pound CO2 tank on that, and it lasts about a year and a half.
Oh, wow.
So that's pretty good for the amount of CO2 that I'm putting in that water.
How much does that cost to fill? It can't be that much.
60 bucks.
Okay, wow, that's pretty efficient.
The empty tank, I think I paid 50 or 60 bucks used for, and I usually swap it out once a year. So it's 60 bucks. So to spend 60 bucks to really cut down on the amount of algae that grows in your aquarium, it's a no brainer, right? So anytime anyone has questions about the hobby, as reluctant as they are to get CO2, I tell them just do it, because anybody who's had CO2 on an aquarium recognizes right away how much easier it is for you to maintain a beautiful looking algae-free aquarium.
Yeah.
What else can I tell you about my setup?
I will say too, while you're thinking of other things, the way it looks is very, for the listeners that haven't seen a picture of it yet, I'm sure you will after the episode, go to the Instagram page, but it is a very picturesque aquarium when you see it. It's one of those things that looks like, you know, almost like an advertising for beautiful planted aquarium. Like, it's very crystal clear water. And I do love the hiding the equipment. Like, I'm somebody who really gets stressed out and annoyed by like contraptions and wires and things. And, you know, I even in my own reptile room, I try to keep things hidden and clean because I just don't like the way that looks. And in many ways it's unavoidable, right? Like, you're going to have cords and whatnot, but I do love trying to hide that into the aquarium, and I think that's what you've done perfectly there, and it looks very, very good.
Yeah, thanks, man. Honestly, that just comes with experience, right? Like, you know, whoever gets their first aquarium, they're going to have the heater in the aquarium, right? It's like impossible to hide, but as you get more experience, as your ambitions grow with what you want to do for your next setup, you can kind of plan these things in advance. And that's kind of one of my biggest tips with people. Like, you know, you're going to start an aquarium and it's going to look kind of ugly, but over the years, it's just going to get better and better. And when you start a new project and you really take your time to plan it the right way, and research all the available tech that, you know, is on the table for you, you can get it to the point where you can really hide things and really make things look beautiful in that sense. I'll tell you about the fish as that are in there. So I really like the aesthetic of really small fish in a really big space. So my focus mostly is on like Danio species, any type of small schooling fish like pencil fish I have in there as well right now. Because it's an open top aquarium, anyone who hasn't seen it, it's got a lot of emergent driftwood and plants. So I kind of try to keep the water level about an inch or two from the top, but I really try to avoid any fish species that are, you know, skittish or, you know, they want to jump out. So it's kind of been a work in progress in that respect. I have ideas in my head about a certain fish species. Like, for example, I bought some rainbow shiners last year, which are just a beautiful North American fish that are really hard to find here in Canada. They turn up, while the males have a beautiful bluish purple color when they're not breeding, but when they're in breeding season, which is around spring or summer, they just turn this really striking red color. So I had that idea in my head of, oh, I want these fish in my tank, right? But I learned pretty quick that they're jumpers, right? And I had probably 10 of them. I did breed most of them, and I got quite a bit of fry out of it. But, you know, eventually putting them in that show tank, it just didn't work out, right? And that's part of the challenge and experience of, you know, having ideas in your head and, you know, wanting a certain look for your aquarium, and, you know, reality just doesn't fit that that narrative that you want it to have. So it was a lot of my daughter, you know, coming and grabbing me and, you know, pointing to the fish flopping on the floor. And of course, I'm not home all the time, right? So especially, you know, working in Calgary, you know, I'm gone for like, you know, 10 or 11 hours out of the day. So eventually all 10 of those shiners, they did, you know,
find their way to
jump
the floor
to their death. Yeah. And yeah, unfortunately. So, you know, that's not something I want to do. I still have some shiner fry in the breeding tank behind me. But I don't think, you know, I don't want to ruin the aesthetic of my show tank by putting a net over it or anything. So for me, it's just about finding fish that, you know, work with the vision that I have. And right now I seem to have found a good balance between certain species of danios, some white cloud minnows, the pencil fish, like I mentioned. Another thing that's kind of important to me is I don't like running that tank at tropical temperatures. So typical tropical temperature would be like 78 degrees Fahrenheit. For me, I like the flexibility of being able to move a lot of my fish into container ponds, outdoor ponds in the summer. So a lot of the fish that I keep, they can survive and even thrive in temperature. Water temperatures as low as, I'm going to flip to Celsius now, but around 10 degrees Celsius outside. So as long as the water doesn't freeze, they're fine. So that's kind of where I'm at with the types of fish that I want to keep. Another hiccup that I ran into is because we have really hard water in Okotoks, I have a water softener. And so I can't really temperature adjust my water changes. So for the longest time, and I'm a huge proponent of water changes, I think that's another one of the super important maintenance tasks that you should do almost on a weekly maintenance to maintain a beautiful tank. Pythons, I don't know if you're familiar with them,
Dylan,
they basically, yeah, great. So like, pythons make things so easy, but for me, I can't really temperature control the water. And for the longest time, I had a big brood bin that I would fill with water. It would sit in my living room for a day to come up to room temperature, and then I would pump that water in. And I did that because some of the tropical fish that I was keeping at the time would just lose it. And as soon as that cold water hit them, sometimes the water coming out of my taps is like 8 degrees. So it's important for me to have that flexibility with fish that can withstand those cold temperatures. So another important part of the hobby for me is, you know, making the hobby work for you. You know, if these are the conditions that exist, you know, don't try to, you know, force your setup to conform. You know, like, you need to conform to, you know, the reality that you're experiencing, right?
Yeah, that's a great point. And for those listening that don't know what the python is, it's basically just like a water changing siphon, but it hooks to your sink so you can create this vacuum that allows you to easily suck water up but then instantly fill by just flipping a switch, basically, and then it uses your sink to fill. I actually had one
for like a life-changing
the pond that I have in my rainbow boas enclosure, but now the sink that I have doesn't have like a normal, you know, threads, so it just, and python just sits coiled up. But it's funny the way you describe the tank really epitomizes the difference between reptile keeping and aquarium keeping in a lot of ways, because I ask you to explain it and you talk about the equipment, the setup, the CO2, the different things you're using, to the point where you actually almost forgot to talk about the species that you keep, which is very opposite from what the reptile world, you start with the species and then start to kind of like expand on how it's kept. But I think that's where I would love to see reptile keeping start to progress to, is starting with that foundation of the platform of how you're caring for it. And then, like you said, you can't force something to work in an environment that it's not going to work in. So creating the environment and then trying to find species that work within that captive environment is really the way to go. Mike, when you look at his aquarium, does it make you want to, obviously you are maintaining some aquariums with the turtles, which we'll get into in a little bit, but does it make you want to get into getting an aquarium or setting up something that's just for fish or plants?
Oh, totally. Absolutely. So I actually briefly had a reef tank just because Ryan had this incredible, this really cool soft coral setup, and that really just seeing and just some of the gadgets that you had to use, the way that you go about controlling environmental parameters, really just like, that's just something I just needed to try. And it was really fun until I brought something home that had a species of flatworm that only ate the most expensive coral, of course, in my tank. So at that point, I literally lost some really cool pieces overnight. That kind of was my end of reef keeping, but that really inspired me to the point that I'm actually keeping all of my reptiles more high tech than I've ever kept them before. Like, pretty much all of my setups have got humidity controllers on them. They all got thermostats, some rheostats too. Just being able to see the success that Ryan's had with his setups by having that individual controls of certain things and some rate limiting nutrients and whatnot just kind of really inspired me to just kind of take that same kind of control over all my setups. And since doing that, I've noticed like these Corydophanes that I got a month ago, they're in a big 2x2x4 setup with, like I was saying, that actually from listening to your show, misting and fog. So they have that micro and those macro droplets. So having that variation, as well as a humidity controller, as well as a thermostat, and having nighttime drops in temperature, they're like, today I just saw them trying to breed, actually, to the point where it's like, I'm gonna have to separate them. But I would have never gotten that before in the past. I think just like having something come in here, get shipped across the country, and then just acclimate that quickly to the point that it's almost problematic. And I credit that to just like taking inspiration really from the fish keeping hobby and trying to keep things high tech and practical when possible.
Yeah. Is the humidity controller connected to a fogger, or do you have that connected to the mister?
So I kind of had to play around with both. So the mister, the problem was is that just turning on and off, that's the biggest strain on the pump. And so The humidity controller didn't really work so well with that. I actually burnt out a pump quite a bit quicker than I had previously. So just the foggers attached to that, and they seem to do really, really well. Just like the $50 ones off Amazon, they're reptile foggers. So they have this hosing that comes out, but just have that attached. And that's able to keep the ambient humidity really, really well. And then depending on the season, because I try really hard to keep all my species similar to what they're found in the wild. So I actually use iNaturalist a lot and just kind of look for some of the densities. And again, that's a trick I got from listening to your show, and try to have those temperature variations too. So usually the fogger stays pretty steady in its parameters, and then the misting, how often, so up to 4 times in a 24-hour period, how long that mister stays on, that's kind of what fluctuates the most.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. Ryan, if you were to recommend to some, let's say somebody who is doing a really great job caring for reptiles and they wanted to get into keeping fish, do you have a recommendation of species, or, you know, because it'd be impossible to jump into what you're doing. That's a lot of learning how to keep plants and trim and you know, use the CO2 and whatnot. Is there a good entry point for people who are fairly skilled at animal husbandry but have zero fish experience?
Yeah, you know, I think it depends on the type of reptile keeper you are. Like you touched on it earlier, the focus with a lot of people that keep reptiles is on the animal first, and then you kind of build around it. And I think that's kind of how it is when people first get into fish keeping and that sort of thing. But I think what a lot of new fish keepers don't understand is that having plants is going to make your life so much easier. They're the worst thing that could happen to your aquarium is for it to get overrun by algae and you get frustrated and you just give up, right? Doesn't matter how pretty the fish are in there, you're going to hate the look of it. So I try, and this, when I worked in a pet store, you know, in university, I always tried to get people to get in on plants as well. They look more natural. They're going to take a ton of the headache out of the hobby. And there's really just some fundamental steps you can take from the plant husbandry side of it that will translate really well into the fish keeping side of it. So for fish, it kind of depends on what size of aquarium you want to have. So if you, you know, lots of people want these, initially they want these big predatory fish because they look really cool, but it really cuts down on the other more utilitarian fish that you could have, you know, fish that are going to do a good job tidying up, like corydoras or otters or those sorts of things. So I think for most reptile keepers that want to get into the aquarium hobby, they should probably start with like a peaceful community tank. Get as many plants as you can off the start with solid lighting, and then just kind of upgrade things as you go. You don't need a crazy filter right off the bat, but it is going to make maintenance a lot easier the more flow you have. To an extent, of course, you don't want like a whirlpool in there, but you do want to match the type of fish that you're keeping with the conditions that you're creating. So I think it's a little more easier right off the bat with the terrarium because, you know, you can just put the reptile in the terrarium and you don't necessarily have to have plants. With fish, I think it's just a little more important to think about the habitat you're creating and at least learn the fundamentals that come with starting an aquarium and maintaining the balance, which in a lot of ways can take up to a year. Even with my show tank upstairs, I was struggling with certain species of plants for the first like up to maybe 8 months or so. It just takes a certain level of maturity. I think the micro and macro fauna have to kind of develop on their own, and that just takes time. Eventually, aquariums, they become stable enough with consistent conditions where you can keep any plant or any fish up to, of course, considering size constraints of those animals. So
yeah, it's almost like there's this maturity that goes through, and both hobbies have this where you start in your teenage years, not actually as a teenager, but you're acting like a teenager when you want to get into it. It's like, I'm just gonna get a peacock bass and a stingray. It's like the equivalent of a kid like pulling the e-brake every time they turn a corner, and then when you become old, you're like, wow, that was so dumb, like I was just wasting things. Wasting tires, wasting gas. It's like that, but that's sort of the equivalent. You don't really use your head as much. You're like, I'm just gonna jump into the thing that I think must look cool, and then you realize, wow, I don't even have the skill set to be doing what I'm doing. So it starts small, and most people probably should be keeping those types of species anyway. It's same on the reptile side. With the larger species, it can be pretty hard to manage. So I know I eventually will get back into fish. I kept cichlids for quite a long time, and I love them. I can't wait to get into fish. Now is not the time. I feel like I'm not in the right space, and I don't have the time, but I'm very much looking forward to doing it because I will be able to do what I wish I could do, like with the reptile, keeping reptiles, and this is for many people who are listening and maybe you guys as well. I started keeping and then started figuring out how to do it properly. So you kind of are halfway, you're started before you were like, you know, too far down the road before having to reset a good foundation. So I just can't wait to get into fish because I know I'll be able to do it as good as I could possibly do it, get the right tech, get the right equipment, do the right research, and just do one tank and have a really, a really cool tank that I'm proud of that I know will function properly, that you can kind of get to off the on the right foot. So that I'm very much looking forward to. So I don't know if, Mike, you might do that too if you're someone that doesn't have a fish tank yet, but I'm looking forward to that.
Totally, and really well put, exactly. Like you're just that progression of kind of prioritizing when you're keeping animals. I totally agree with that.
Yeah, I am. Well, speaking of that, let's talk about the turtles, because the turtles is one of those areas where people do run into trouble. There's many different types of, you know, different species. It's, as you had mentioned at the beginning of the show, it's one of the group of animals in our industry that does tend to get abused just because, A, they live forever. They can live through almost anything. They just don't die even when they're kept in the worst conditions. So maybe you could tell us a little bit more about the two species that you keep. How large are they as adults? And do you, would you recommend, if somebody is just a diehard, I need a turtle, are these two species that are good candidates for somebody who you could actually, you know, we're talking about an individual who you would trust to do the right thing?
Yeah. So the wood turtle is not necessarily a species that I'd say is like a great and very accessible species for beginner. The reason why I got her is there was a person in town here that just, I saw on Kijiji, had some really, really inexpensive babies. So I was like, oh my gosh. Because, you know, at that point, I'd see them offer quite a bit for quite a bit more. So I was like, oh, I'll go check them out, and saw them. And the way that this person was keeping them, I don't know, he must have gotten the babies. I can't imagine he bred them himself, but they were kept really, really dry, and I could already see some kind of scutes not forming the best on the wood turtle. So that's why I brought her home. And that was a learning process for me too, because previously to keeping her, all I'd had was a common stink pot and then an eastern box turtle. And I love that box turtle. Just my living situation changed pretty quickly, and so unfortunately I had to rehome her. So I was kind of looking to fill that niche again, and that's why I got the wood turtle. But that was such a process, and you can actually still see on her shell, it's almost like a tree stump when you cut. You can see the rings, and you can kind of see from when I got her and when I'm starting to figure things out until when things got totally figured out. And basically I was keeping her like a box turtle, because that's all, you know, all these care sheets online that you'd see, that's what I'd read. And then there was one person on Instagram, and I cannot remember this person's name. Unfortunately, they're not very active anymore, so I can't remember. But I just saw that he was keeping them almost in a pond, and I was like, that's just so different than everything else. So I reached out to him, and he was really kind and messaged me back, and, you know, kind of shared that the trick to keeping these guys is essentially keeping them semi-aquatic. And as soon as I converted her enclosure to about half water, just this drastic change, and she was more outgoing. She would just eat things way more readily. She was more curious. She'd come out, just really inquisitive, because there are really intelligent species. And I find that lots of land turtles, I don't know if it's just from having to be visual hunters, but they're really, really inquisitive and they're really intelligent. And you could just see that change. And unfortunately, you know, that took a couple months to get there, but such a cool animal. I think they get up to about 8 inches. Someone's going to probably skewer me because that's not right, but they're definitely a smaller land turtle for sure. And I think that would be a good, like, you know, graduation turtle, maybe not where you'd want to start, but a really good one, just because you're getting some of that aquatic and that terrestrial side of things, and you're getting that buffer. But if someone was looking to get into turtles, like, musk turtles are just amazing. I think mud turtles are also really popular. We can't keep them here in Alberta, but musk turtles are pretty much almost entirely aquatic. They're some of the smallest species of turtles. And most of them are found in North America. So you don't need these crazy parameters. You're not trying to replicate something that might be really difficult, or trying to procure food items for them that would be really hard to find. So I ended up with the loggerhead musk turtle, just because it is a smaller species. They usually max out about 5 inches. They're unfortunately not very common, which is too bad, because they're really inquisitive. You're getting all, they're like a snapping turtle really in such a small package. And like, she'll come right out. She can, like, she's watching me right now, cause she can hear me, talking away. So she's sitting here waiting for some night crawlers, but that's definitely, like, bar none, like, either common stink pot or a musk turtle. Like, that is such a good entry species. And not even if you're new to reptiles, like, if you're just looking for a good pet that is engaging, like my wife, she's not by any means a reptile person. She likes animals and whatnot, but when she comes down here, like, that's what she likes most, is the turtles. They're just really accessible to, I think, lots of people. And the just staying that small, like, I've got her in a 4 foot long tank with, I have a custom background just so she can get out. And I mean, really a small amount of space. Like, she only sticks to half of the tank, which makes me feel good, because she's got the space where she could go if she wants, but she's kind of got her territory set out. And it's in a really small space. And when you look at things like sliders, like, they just need so much room. And that's just something really hard to offer inside. And also, they're just sun worshipers. And if you're not going to offer high quality UVB and monitor that output, they have such high calcium needs, just by maintaining that shell, you know, they really, it needs to be something that's on point. And that's just something I think it's really hard to do, especially up here in Canada, where we can't necessarily, or at least where we live in Canada, you can't keep things outside year round. And I think that's really important consideration for some of these bigger species. So that would be my recommendation, is just starting with those musk turtles. And I mean, within that family of turtles, there's so much diversity in every color. Like if you were to put a loggerhead next to a stink pot, I mean, they couldn't be two more different colors and patternings. And, you know, care needs are almost identical, like very, very similar.
Yeah. Ryan, when you were saying that you were potentially thinking of doing a turtle aquarium, what was that going to be in your future aquarium? And if so, what was the species you were thinking of? And then why did Mike say it was terrible?
I had actually, I think I narrowed it down to a musk turtle. And so actually when Aqua Decor was designing that custom background for me, I wanted them to make the top as steep as possible so that turtle couldn't get out. And then I was just going to have like a dock, like a floating dock type thing that the turtle could get out of the water with. And I think it was a musk turtle, but I wanted the, because I had already bought the CO2 reactor at that point. Like I knew I wanted it to be heavily planted, but yeah, Mike just brought me right back down to earth when he explained to me what these turtles do to a lot of planted setups. And I realized it wasn't going to work out as I had envisioned it in my head.
It's going to look good when you put the turtle in, but when you wake up the next morning, you'll have some floating plants.
It'd be good for probably like one or two reels, and then it would just look like a disaster.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, like the conversation that where we veered that way, because Ryan had, you know, told me this is what I want to do. And of course, it's like, awesome. Like, that sounds great. And then in the message, because we just, you know, message each other all random, we'll find random stuff on Instagram and reels and whatnot, and send it to each other. And he sent me one of a planted tank and this really nice carpet of Monte Carlo or something. He was like, this is what I want to do. And I was like, man, that'll make it about 2 seconds. Like, I love my musk turtle, but she is a wrecking ball. And like, even floating plants, she's figured out a way to absolutely destroy. So literally all I've got in there is just inert wood, some big driftwood, and then I have an emergent monstera and then some pothos, because it's just, those are such robust plants that really she can't do the damage. They're able to recover quickly, but they're so food oriented that they will just go through every nook and cranny looking for food. And usually that means ripping out all these really nice, carefully manicured plants.
And they have the strength to do it. It's not like they want to but can't, but they can absolutely pull plants from the soil and whatnot.
No problem at all, yeah, for sure.
For a while there, I still had it in my mind, like, maybe I can make this work, because, you know, like, I don't know if I'm like you guys, but I'll Google something until I find someone that is making it work, and then boom, that's proof that I can do it. But it only took me maybe one visit. Yeah, one visit down to Mike's house in Lethbridge and like watching his musk turtle, I was like, yeah, it's never going to happen.
Yeah, you can pray as much as you want, but as soon as you see them in action, you're like, yeah, this is just not going to work.
Yeah, exactly.
Ryan, do you have any interest in getting into keeping reptiles again at some point? Or right now, are you focused on the fish? Obviously, you said you potentially want to get back into keeping more inverts and whatnot. And, you know, you have a young daughter, so that keeps you very busy, I'm sure. But is reptiles on the horizon somewhere?
You know, I'm not sure. Like you said, my main focus with anything terrestrial would probably be inverts. Like mantids are just some, like, I remember the first time, I think the first mantid I kept was maybe a ghost mantid, and they were just like otherworldly to me, the way they moved. I was really into macro photography at the time. And so being able to take like close-ups of, critters like mantids and jumping spiders is really probably what would drive me into getting something in a terrarium. The biggest driver for me, I really like terrariums that, you know, almost act as like a centerpiece in a room. So that, I think Mike agrees with me, like our setups are almost as important to us as what we're keeping. Sure. Like we want it to look beautiful. We want things to be hidden. We want it to be automated. And For me, I probably, let me put it this way. I haven't found a reptile that I would devote that amount of time to, only because I think mantids and other invertebrates are just like really, really cool and really low maintenance as well. That was the biggest thing with mantids is, you know, they survive longer when you feed them like once a week or a couple times a week, and you don't have to put too much attention into caring for them. They just kind of, especially when you have everything automated, it just looks really nice and you can check in on them and film them every now and again. But yeah, like you said, with a toddler, and I don't know what the future holds, but I'm only probably going to have less time until I retire. Yeah. So I don't want to set myself up for, you know, a situation where anything gets neglected or I end up changing my mind a year later.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what's good about some of those inverts is they don't live that long. So you're not getting into a 30-year commitment with an animal. It's, you know, 2 or 3 years. Anybody that I've talked to who's kept mantids is just obsessed with them. So I think that is a cool thing to keep.
Yeah, absolutely. There's something else. Like, I remember actually I bought one of those, Owatheke from Home Depot, and people, these are just like mantid egg cases that people put in their garden, kind of like ladybugs to eat pest organisms. And watching that thing, missing it every day, and then having it like randomly hatch out like 200 mantid nymphs was just like one of the coolest things I've ever experienced. So
that's cool.
Once I have my garden and my backyard up and running, I'll definitely be getting more of those, because I was still finding, you know, little mantids out there, you know, into the fall. So it's great.
That's cool. And Mike, for the enclosures that are behind you, they're beautiful as well. They're really well done. What are those? Did you make those, or are those, did you buy those, the actual enclosure themselves?
So kind of a little bit of both. So I just, sometimes I'll just have a really hard time. I'll just see a new product come out and I'm just like, oh man, I'll just like sit there, ruminate and kind of wait for it to go on sale. So I've got like a Zen behind me, and then I've got a custom built glass behind me. So with those like very little modification, and then on this side, I've got a big Zoomed mesh terrarium, but just the mesh wasn't working for keeping the humidity that I needed to and insulating. So that was just replacing the screening with some polycarb greenhouse panels.
Yeah.
So having those on the side and then lining the inside with cork insulation panels, that dark cork kind of. And so just a little bit of tweaking and then pulling off the screening on the door and replacing it with just like a thin acrylic, just to kind of help with viewing and whatnot. So like a little bit of both. I think kind of the more and more I go, the like it's more so I just see that it sometimes it can be a little bit more expensive to modify something or build it yourself, but you're getting what you want, and it's a little bit more work and a little bit more time, but having to replace something in a year or two is not worth it. And I was really excited to get this custom built aquarium behind me, and it was just like a disaster at every step. Like it broke before we even got it in. Ryan had to come down from Calgary one day when we were fishing, so he just stopped here anyways to help me actually move it. And it's just so heavy, and it's not working for what I need it to be. So I mean, like, definitely probably moving towards more PVC and just having stuff that's a little more functional, I guess, rather than just worrying about what it looks like.
Yeah. It is nice to be able to just quickly move things. And if you have something that needs two people to move, then you're kind of locked into that configuration until, you know, your buddy comes over, Ryan comes over next, you know. And you guys have to deal with the same climate that I have to deal with as far as the dryness. That is a big thing, right? You know, when the humidity in your room drops to like 10% in winter, you know, screen is cool when you're in Florida,
but
when you're in the prairies, it's not as cool. It's really dry, and it's just not, this moisture just disappears instantly. So yeah, you do have to make those modifications.
Totally.
We fantasize about moving to Florida like multiple times a month.
Yeah. It's a weekly topic. Yeah. We'll just find a like, cool, like,
we see people's outdoor ponds or, you know, outdoor setups for their reptiles and stuff. But then we also see videos of crazy people in Florida and we're like,
Calgary. Alberta's not that bad. I mean, when in the summertime in Manitoba, it's insanely humid. It's very, very humid here. We have a ton of lakes. Obviously, you guys know there's large lakes here. So when it gets hot, it's quite humid, but nothing like Florida. I went to Florida in September and I was just like, wow, this is insane. It is so, it's so humid. Everything is super wet all the time. It's just like the walls are weeping, and which is seems a bit like a black mold situation, maybe. I don't know, but maybe that accounts for some of the craziness down there. I don't know.
Yeah,
but
that must be it. I think you figured it out, man.
Yeah. But you know, every climate has its own pros and cons. So obviously modifying your own enclosures is key. There's something else I was going to say, but I think maybe it has disappeared. As far as moving forward, is there any forward plans? Is it change new animals or different projects? Or are you guys just going to kind of keep working on what you're working on?
I'm hoping to make the tank behind me like a 40-gallon breeder and divide it into three segments just so I can breed a few different types of fish. I bought some Florida flag fish since we're on the topic of Florida. Which are another like really beautiful, curious North American fish that has the great benefit of also eating all sorts of nuisance algae, like especially algae that's really hard to get rid of. I have put them in the aquarium behind me a couple weeks ago, and they have just decimated this cladophora algae, which, you know, a lot of hobbyists resort to chemical methods to get rid of it from their aquariums. And these things just ate everything within a matter of weeks. So they're a little harder to find here and they're pretty expensive. So I'm hoping to focus on those in the next, or at least over the summer. They're also another fish that would probably do pretty well in a container pond and that sort of thing. So other than that, I think I told you, I want to get another jumping spider, maybe some mantids, but I think it's important for me and Mike, like we're not going to put too much pressure on turning Strange Life into a business or anything. We're just kind of going to keep doing what we're doing and let our passions guide us. And I'm sure we'll end up being happy with the end product, wherever it goes.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about you, Mike?
Yeah, I think I'm at a point where I'm keeping the things that I've really wanted, that I really do want to keep and that I've thought about. And so I think I'm not actively looking for things, but I mean, like some of the agamid species, like the colodes and whatnot, like I'm just, if those came across, like something like that for sure, but I'm probably going to just stay put where I'm at for now and just work at maintaining. I've got a little, actually my wife's pregnant, so we've got a kid coming at the end of the summer. So I'm just trying to be conscientious of that too, because like Ryan was saying, something that we both really have experienced in the past and work hard to avoid now is when the hobby turns into a chore. And I mean, sometimes that's unavoidable, but like right now, my, for lack of a better term, self-care is like coming down from work, is coming into my basement and getting to spend time with my animals before, you know, me and my wife do what we need to do. And that's important to me to keep it that way, where it's something that I can do to de-stress and decompress from my day. So with the current level of animals that I've got and the maintenance level, I think I'm pretty much optimized in that regard and a bit of a buffer. I'm going to be eating these words in a couple months, I'm sure, but that I think will be good when I have a little guy here in terms of time. So I think right now I'm not actively looking for anything, but you know, there's a couple, you know, grail species that I think if I came across and were accessible, I would definitely be interested in keeping. But another kind of step that me and Ryan are looking at taking with Strange Life is, like I was saying, we're both fly fishers. Ryan's unfortunately a lot better than I am. But
it's not true.
We'll see. But including some of that content, like when we go out, like Ryan, like the last couple of trips we took last year, Ryan was able to use some different techniques that, you know, we haven't used previously that I think would be really interesting to kind of record. And then when we're out there, every time we're out there, you'll just see some crazy stuff that just, it's cool to see nature being nature. And so like trying to cross a river and then just seeing kind of like this like school of like rainbow trout go across you. So I think looking at ways to kind of include that, because that's a really big passion. I almost as big, I would say, as keeping animals in captivity is, you know, fishing and going out and looking. Like, me and Ryan used to go out and look for ammonite fossils. Like, we live on a really old riverbed, and we're really lucky that there's quite a few deposits around here, and going fishing and going flipping rocks and logs and seeing what we can find and whatnot. So I think maybe, like, next step we've talked about is including a little bit more of that in the strange life, as well as just branching out into kind of that other interest that we have that I think is still really relevant. I think lots of people might be interested in seeing as well.
Yeah, that'll be fascinating. And yeah, I think you make a good point about kind of keeping where you are, especially with a child coming all along. I've talked about this in the podcast before, but I was very shocked at how, this is, sounds bad when I first say it, but how little I cared about my animals when my son was first born. Like, it's not like you have a disdain for them. You just almost forget them. You know, like, sometimes like, oh my God, I haven't been downstairs in like 2 days. I have to go down there. You know, you forget. And, you know, it comes back, obviously, after it's the first couple of weeks that are kind of really shocking. It's quite a change, but it does very much adjust your, what you place value on, and your animals will always have value, but suddenly you'll have this, you know, human that you're responsible for, and it will outweigh everything by a magnitude that you can't even understand until it happens. And yeah, I think it's really good to kind of keep where you're at, keep something that's manageable, and eventually you'll have a little helper, but, you know, that's like that's like an 8-year totally. investment.
That's the best part. Yeah.
So hopefully
that's the trickle down. Yeah,
exactly, the trickle down economics. Eventually you have a couple helpers, but yeah, you're gonna have to put in the groundwork at first. So I'm sure by the listeners just listening to this conversation, you can tell that both of you have a really great friendship and a neat friendship as well, to be able to work on this project together. And I'm very excited to see how it progresses and the projects that you continue to pump out. Can one of you let everybody know where to find Strange Life Labs online so they can peruse through the pictures and stay up to date?
Yeah, we're on Instagram. You can just search us, Strange Life Labs. I think we're on Facebook too, but we don't go on Facebook. So if you're going to interact with us, don't interact with us there. It just automatically gets posted there.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you both very much for this. I had a blast chatting with you. Is there anything that we didn't mention today that you wanted to wrap up with? If not, that's okay. I just want to make sure that I give you a last word if you had any last things you wanted to say.
Nothing for me. Thanks, though.
I just want to say thanks again, Dylan. Like, this is a really kind of like weird full circle moment, because I remember the first time listening to your show was driving out to meet Ryan to go do something. I don't know if we're going to a show, or we're going to go fishing or something. And the first time I listened to the podcast was actually going to go do Strange Life stuff. So it's pretty incredible to be here and to talk with you. So we really appreciate the opportunity.
No problem at all. I really appreciate you guys agreeing to come on. And yeah, it's always fun chatting with other people who are, you know, up to some interesting things. So I'm glad that we could make this work, and we'll absolutely stay in touch and watch the Strange Life Labs continue to progress into the future. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Dylan.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Dylan.
All right. That is the end of that episode. Mike and Ryan, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast, and thank you for doing the work that you do. I'm very excited to watch your projects progress. But even as I said, I just love the, I hesitate to call it a brand because I don't want to fall into this like business category, but Strange Life Labs, just the way it feels when I look at the page, it just feels good. And I'm so excited to be able to have you on the show and talk about what you're doing. Listeners, if you enjoyed the episode, make sure you let us know. You can either comment on Spotify or on YouTube. I'll try to get back to most of the YouTube comments. The Spotify ones, I can't comment back. It just doesn't let me, but I will see them and I'll read them, of course. If you enjoyed the podcast, you can also share it on social media, Facebook or Instagram. That really does go a long way to helping more listeners find the show, which at the end of the day, we really want to do. Please go check out patreon.com/animalsathome if you are interested in supporting the podcast financially. You can also check out the show's sponsor, customreptilehabitats.com. There is an affiliate link in both the show notes and the YouTube description. If you click that and make a purchase, a commission comes back to me at no extra cost to you. You can find me on Instagram at animalsathomeca. Try to answer most of my DMs there if you want to get in touch. And I think that is it. I will catch you guys in the next episode.